All right, it's good to be together tonight as we continue our study in the book of Joshua. As I said, we're probably going to spend about three lessons on the text itself, and so we are going to finish up lesson number one this evening and then move into lesson number two, hopefully. I anticipate that what we'll probably do is get through about the memory work for lesson number two, and then that'll leave us Sunday to answer all the questions, and then that will allow us to get into lesson number three about the connections to Jesus, connections to the New Testament in the lesson following that. If you've been memorizing some things, remember that we've gone through the first 12 chapters. And so if you keep on working on that, you'll be able to have a key word for every chapter as we work our way through, and you'll have all of Joshua, at least the main chapters, memorized so that you can get the big overall theme, so that then you can see how this all works together as we move into Judges after this. That being said, let's go ahead and move forward into, here's a review. I won't go through it again, but we have those 12 chapters there. And then let's move into question number 5 in our text, our workbook. Number 5, summarize the divine battle plan for Jericho. What was God's plan there? How were they going to take Jericho? Silently, for the most part. Yes, yes. And
walk around once a day. 7th day, walk around 6 times.
All right, that's not a typical military strategy, but it was God's strategy. And in fact, we didn't really discuss it, but who gave Joshua that plan? Does anyone remember? As you're reading through, who came and spoke to Joshua and said, this is what you need to do? Yeah, the angel of the Lord. And then that's at the end of chapter 6, and then you get into the beginning of chapter 5, and the angel seems to still be speaking, and then it shifts into Yahweh is saying. And so there seems to be some connection to the angel of the Lord, the messenger of the Lord, and Yahweh himself. But this is the plan, that they are to march around the city for 6 days, once a day, and then they are to, the people are to be silent, if I remember correctly. Your priests are going to be blowing trumpets, and then on the 7th day, not only are the trumpets going to be blown, but then the people are going to give a great shout after 7 rounds, and then the wall will fall, and then they can go in and destroy the city. Now, that being said, what was the result? Did it work? Absolutely. The walls came tumbling down, as we sometimes sing, and yet, as you move forward in the narrative, the very next city they come to is what city? Ai, or I, or however you want to pronounce it. And what happened there? Yeah, they were defeated. And why were they defeated? There's a connection here to Jericho. What had happened in Jericho? Yeah, someone had taken the spoils. Who was it? Achan had taken the spoil. And as we have on the screen here, that you have this word, kerem, which is translated ban, the things under the ban in Joshua 6 and verse 17. This word is sometimes translated devoted to destruction, depending on your translation. We won't do this optional assignment, but you can look up every time that that word is used. I gave you a link to a free website that will let you see every time that word is used, or you can use a QR code that's on the worksheets. And just kind of follow that through, because that is an interesting word to consider. All of this was to be dedicated to God. And so none of the people were to take it for themselves. This all belonged to God. And so that makes the infraction all the worse, because who is Achan stealing from? He's stealing from Yahweh. He's stealing from God. And as he steals from God, then he and his entire family fall under a curse. They're going to be punished. I tend to think that there's some rebellion in his heart all the way up into the confession, but, you know, that's reading a little bit between the lines. His entire family is destroyed for his sin. They may have been complicit with the things that were going on since it was in the tent. But regardless, this was something that was going to cause his entire family to die. And if it had not been taken care of, since the sin was in the camp, the whole camp would be at loss. They would not have God on their side until they took care of this sin. And I think that, though we're not necessarily, I don't think we're going to make this point as we move into the lesson about the New Testament connections, that does show why God is so concerned about sin within a church is because it does have a leavening effect. And that's why there is this plan for withdrawal, is because you have to remove sin from among yourselves for the good of the one who is sinning, but also for the good of the congregation. Same thing was happening here with the people of Israel, except there was very tangible effect in which they could not win a battle until they took care of that sin. All right, any additional comments or questions there? Yes, Josh.
This does set an example of what utterly destroyed should mean. So when Saul was supposed to utterly destroy, he should know what that would mean.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, very good. So, and we'll talk about the Amalekites in a future lesson. We'll see that connection, especially when we get to the United Kingdom. Another comment? All right. I would point out, we don't have time necessarily tonight to kind of dig into it, but the word trouble is used here of Achan in Joshua 6 and verse 18. You also see it in chapter 7 and verse 25, but there's going to be a connection with this word in which Elijah is referred to as a troubler of Israel, and then he turns that back on Ahab, and in which he is called the one who is troubled. He and his father's house have troubled. And so that word troubled seems to indicate that there's this influence beyond oneself, and thus the sin was going to come upon him. If you want to look that up on your own, you can look in 1 Kings 18, 17 and 18, and the parallel in 1 Chronicles 2 and verse 7, where you have, for Achan himself, where it's talking about that troubling of Israel because of sin. All right, so let's move on to question number 6. So God won the battle for the people in Jericho miraculously. They march around, the walls come tumbling down. In Ai, it seems to be somewhat more providential than miraculous, in which you actually see a kind of clever battle strategy in which when they go back, they act like they're running away again, and then this time you've got another group that's coming in behind and taking the city, and they're closed in from both sides. That's actually a tactic that's going to be used by the Greeks during the time of Esther and such, where the Persians are trying to go in, and the strategy was you go up and try to fight the Greeks, and they'll separate and then enclose you and destroy you. This is just a typical battle strategy that is sometimes used, where you get two fronts going so that you can destroy them in the middle. And so that's how they eventually destroy Ai. But what did Joshua and Israel do in response to the work of God among them? As God has won these battles for them, what does Joshua 8, 30 through 35 say they did in response to that? Mm-hmm. Very good. And they made a copy of the law. You have the event of the blessings and the cursings. I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. That is a connection to the previous quarter with Deuteronomy. But this seems to be something that we could apply as well, is that when we see God's work among us, the proper response is worship. That you offer a sacrifice to God, a sacrifice of praise. You think about what he has said. You think about his promises that have been made. And in that, there is this response to God. Notice, they're not taking credit for the victories at Jericho or Ai. They're giving God all the credit, and they're offering the sacrifices to him in response to that. And the same would be true of us. Though God does expect us to cooperate with him and do things as it relates to our salvation, our sanctification, ultimately all the glory goes back to him. And we offer ourselves, we offer sacrifices to him, of praise to him in response. Now, I said I mentioned this about the Mount Ebal and Gerizim, blessings and cursings. Someone quickly summarized that. What had been said in Deuteronomy? I don't know how much you got to talk about this. Deuteronomy was, I think Brad said you guys had to scream through the book of Deuteronomy. But did you get a chance in that class to talk about the Ebal, Gerizim? All right, can someone summarize what Moses had commanded and what they eventually do here? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so you were to do, and then in that, they were going to be responding to one another, one on Mount Gerizim, one on Mount Ebal, and there would be this kind of call response type thing, is the curses and the blessings are shown to them. And so this is a reminder of what Moses had already told them. Now, if you're interested, you know, there's still more research that's being done, and there's probably going to be more released sometime in the summer. But Dr. Scott Stripling has uncovered a very interesting find on Mount Ebal. At the end of 2019, he found that the results, COVID kind of messed things up, but he's going to release a publication on that. And they have found a little 2-inch cursing tablet that is made out of lead. And through a lot of, in Prague, I can't remember what process they were using, but they were able to decipher what was inside this lead tablet that had been closed in on itself. And as it looks right now, we still need to be critical. We still need to be making sure that it's reliable information. But this seems to be the oldest piece of Hebrew text that has been found, and it pushes the conquest all the way back to the older date that many of us have typically taken, that most skeptics have not taken. And so that would give great evidence for the veracity of the Joshua story. And so there's things going on right now, and this would be one of the most amazing finds in recent years. It's on par with like the Dead Sea Scrolls as it relates to the historicity of the Old Testament. So you can look that up. I think, in fact, Appian Media has released some interviews and such from Dr. Stripling that is showing some of these results in time. And so this is happening right now, and it's very interesting.
So if I'm understanding correctly, that would push the date earlier?
Yes, it would push it to the mid-15th century, 1400s.
Story have said that it didn't happen because of the dating of some of the things of the archaeologists later.
Yes.
On.
Yes. So
eliminate that and strengthen all the other evidence that's really there that they tried to ignore.
Absolutely. So skeptics typically say that there was no written Hebrew alphabet at the time of the 1400s, 1500s, when Moses supposedly, they say, wrote the law. And that there's no evidence of Israel in Canaan before the 12th or 13th or 14th centuries. And so they would push the Exodus to that time and the conquest to that, or they wouldn't even say a conquest. Most skeptics would just say they kind of assimilated and came out of Canaan. But this would show that there is actual evidence that we have in our hand of Hebrew text in the 1400s in Israel, showing that Israel did exist before the skeptics say they actually existed, which matches perfectly with the story. And what's even more amazing is that this little maybe personal curse tablet that this person is maybe trying to connect themselves to the blessings and the cursings, it mentions the name of Yahweh 2 or 3 times. It's about 2 centimeters big, but it's on Mount Ebal, where the cursings were actually happening. So it fits perfectly with the Bible story. And so you can research that a little bit more if you'd like. Just Google it. In fact, if you haven't seen it already, there are all kinds of, I mean, the Jerusalem Post top, it was a front page story in the Jerusalem Post, this finding. And so there's more coming, and we'll see what happens as the publication comes in this summer. All right, so again, isn't it interesting how the archaeology always seems to prove that the Bible is right? And so that's exactly what's happening, it seems, at this point, unless some other evidence.
Any thoughts on why verse 26, the curse that Joshua placed on the Israelites, why that was Jericho? Is it, I mean, it was, I guess, one of the oldest cities in the world that they believed was one of the oldest cities in the world. It was wickedness. God destroying them because of the wickedness that he's placing that, or do you have any thoughts?
I don't have any thoughts as to his motivation. Does anybody have any thoughts on Joshua's motivation? I mean, that seems reasonable that this is the first city they're coming to, and they're just like Moab and Ammon, they're not really welcoming the Israelites except for Rahab. Anybody have any thoughts on that?
Kind of like the first fruits offering, that same kind of idea, that this is the first city of Canaan, and so it's devoted to
Mm-hmm. So the devoted to destruction idea may play out in his curse that no one should rebuild this. Now, when you get to 1 Kings chapter 16, what happens? Someone rebuilds it. And it happens exactly as Joshua says. And since I'm not teaching the divided kingdom, I'll throw in a little something that I find interesting, is that it appears that when you get to Omri's dynasty, you are having what I would probably call a reverse conquest. That whereas the people came in to Jericho, destroyed it, and then Yahweh took the land and cast out Baal, now you have a Sidonian woman who is bringing Baal back in through the kingdom, and they are pushing God out, and Jericho is rebuilt. Maybe that's why that little tidbit about Jericho is thrown in, not only for prophecy, but to show this is the downward spiral, that now the conquest is being reversed. Baal's winning. And so God is going to go on the offense in chapter 17 when you get to Elijah and Elisha. He's going to send his forerunner and his prophet who does double the miracles, and they're going to fight back against Baal. And so it could be that you have some echoes of the conquest in the divided kingdom. But I'm not teaching that, so whoever teaches that can maybe deal with that as they want. Yes, Brother Sam.
Why did Joshua make that curse? 1 Kings 16:34 seems to indicate that he was at the direction of the Lord.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So yes, that would be the ultimate motivation, is that God told him to. Why?
Typically say that in Joshua, but King of Kings did give the indication that God directed Joshua.
Sure. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Any other thoughts? All right, moving on to number 7. The Gibeonites used a lie to their advantage. This is the second act of deceit that we have seen. Rahab was the first. What did the leaders of Israel, including Joshua, not do before they made peace with Gibeon? They didn't inquire of the Lord. Whenever you see that kind of language, you always know something bad is coming next. They did not inquire of the Lord. They did not ask God. And here's an interesting thing that just kind of popped up for me the last time, or as I was reading through multiple times here in this text. From verse 18, how did the Israelites respond to their leaders? Yeah, they were against it. And they start grumbling against their leaders. Now, in the wilderness, it always seems like they're grumbling against leaders who are doing the right thing. Now you have a generation that's grumbling against their leaders who are doing the wrong thing. And so I think there's a picture there that whenever leadership does not inquire of the Lord and follow God's path, then it's right for the people to grumble against them. However, it seems that part of their grumbling was they wanted them to break this covenant, and they determined they would not break this covenant. Whether that is right or wrong, that is just described, not necessarily, there's not a, here's the moral of the story, don't do, you have a, here's the moral of the story, don't do this, but the second part of whether or not the covenant should have been broken, I tend to think that since they had spared the Gibeonites, God was okay with them sparing the Gibeonites, because then Saul is condemned for his killing the Gibeonites after a covenant has been made. And David kind of restores Gibeon of sorts. And so that seems to be at least some kind of stamp of approval, that even though they did it wrong by making an alliance with Gibeon, maybe there could have been another way other than if they had inquired of the Lord. But it seems like God didn't want them to break that covenant after it had been made. But I wouldn't be dogmatic about that. All right. Yes. I thought I heard someone say something. Anybody have any comments or questions on that?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. Now, let me just throw this in, and I don't have time to let the can of worms all the way out, but this text has been used by some to say that, well, if you're in an adulterous marriage, then you can just stay in it because you shouldn't break that vow. That's comparing apples and oranges. That's not what this would be saying. Adultery would be an ongoing sin, and so that would have to be something. Repentance would mean the breaking of that marriage if it's an adulterous one. All right, so If you want to talk about that more later, we can. But this text is not approving. I would not use a text where they did not inquire of the Lord as approval for something you want to do in keeping an adulterous marriage going. All right, number 8. Joshua asked God to prolong the day so that he could win the war against the kings. In what book was Joshua's poetic prayer first included? Jasher. Yeah, the book of Jasher. Is that in your Bible? It's not in my Bible either. There is actually an apocryphal, or I guess it'd be pseudepigraphal work that was written in the time between the Testaments. It's called the book of Jasher, but that's not this book of Jasher. That's something that someone made up and borrowed the title. But though Joshua uses a book that's not in our Bible, does the inclusion of non-biblical literature in the Bible deny the inspiration of Scripture or affirm the inspiration of these other works? No. Why? All right, very good. Neither approves nor disproves. What else do you have on that?
Yes. Paul quoted the great poets.
Mm-hmm. Yep, very good. So Paul quoted Gentiles. Acts chapter 17, Titus chapter 1, 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Jude probably quotes from a non-canonical book called the Book of Enoch. It seems to be very closely connected. But just because there is a quotation of something that is not inspired, one does not mean that that book is inspired. It just means that it says something correct at that point. You can make a point from it. For instance, though Paul did not believe we are all the offspring of Zeus, he could say in Acts chapter 17, applied to the right God, we are all his offspring. And so it'd be kind of like sometimes Stephen and I quote from C.S. Lewis. Doesn't mean we agree with everything C.S. Lewis says. Doesn't mean we think he's inspired. We're definitely not inspired, but we can take a point that is made and then we can say there is truth here without affirming everything. And so Jasher, we don't know anything about it other than what you have here, and then also in 2 Samuel chapter 1, I believe, where it's quoted again, or at least referred to again. But this is something that we maybe don't dive into very much, that we do need to spend some time with, because skeptics will say, well, why don't you include these books? Look, even the inspired writers included those. And so those may be some things that, at least in upcoming years, as more and more people become skeptical and they have access to the internet, they give them all these arguments, it might be a good idea to kind of dive in and say, how does this work with inspiration? And I think what we find here is that Joshua, by the Spirit, could quote from this book of Jasher without necessarily saying this is a book that needs to be in the Bible. All right, any other comments or questions on any of that? Kevin? Yeah, and so, you know, there is truth in the Old Testament about God's plan for marriage. But of course, all of that has to be in view of what Jesus has said in Matthew chapter 5, Matthew chapter 19, what Paul says for Jesus in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, all these various passages. We have an interpretation of God's plan for marriage in the New Testament. All right, number 9. The Bible mentions the Anakim several times, 17 times actually, and you can look at all those texts if you're interested. And by the end of the conquest, the Anakim were left only in what cities?
Gaza,
Gath, and Ashdod. Now, what nation eventually dwelt in those cities? The Philistines. So, you know any famous kind of powerful Philistines that came from that area? A little bit later in the story? Maybe Goliath and some of his possibly family. Don't know if they were Anakim or Anakim or not, but they definitely, we see that maybe connection that the Anakim, these strong, mighty men, are left in these to-be Philistine cities. I'll have to work out the chronology a little bit more as I'm thinking about it right now. The Philistines, as we think of them, probably don't come into that territory until a little bit later. And we'll have to decide what kind of intermingling might have happened there. It seems that maybe Goliath and the Philistines of that time had come from maybe Cyprus or Crete or something along those lines from Greece. They seem to portray some kind of Greek ideas, kind of one-on-one hero combat type things. But regardless, you do have Anakim there who are strong, mighty men. And then the next thing we see is we're going to see some strong, mighty men coming out and opposing God's people. So might this be that by pushing them out but not totally destroying them, it does come back and haunt them later in the story? All right, any questions about chapters 1 through 12 of Joshua? All right, if I miss your hand, just call out my name because there's a lot of people in front of me and it's hard to always see a hand come up. Again, we're not going to discuss much on the challenge. I just want to offer a potential application that you can take and apply this week if you so decide. All right, so that's the end of this slideshow. And we'll move on to lesson number 2. And there it is, the magic of Kevin in the back. All right, lesson number 2, the inheritance of the tribes of Israel. So this is going to be chapters 13 through 24. And actually, let me go back if I can. As you can already see, I've given it a bit of a title, but as you read through chapters 13 through 24, how did you describe the big idea of this half of Joshua? Fulfillment of God's promise. And so in that way, it kind of parallels what we saw in chapters 1 through 12. Any other thoughts on this?
Dividing the territory.
Very good. So you have all the victories. Now you have the dividing of the territory among all the tribes. Anybody have anything they want to add?
I would say God's promise to them that he's fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's like you were saying, don't trust in the horses, don't trust in your power, trust in me.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And so, in that sense, God is, that by them trusting God, going his way, he is providing the inheritance that he has promised to, all the way back to Abraham. And so the story is continuing. That land promise, as we sometimes refer to it in Genesis chapter 12, 15, 18, 26, I think. You have that promise just keeps on moving forward, till you have the nation that grows up in Egypt, and now they come out of that land in order to go into the new land, and we've had some delays on the road until now finally they have conquered the territory, and now it is being dispersed to them. I was doing some study in Jeremiah 17, just recently, about the sin of Judah is written with a pen of iron and with a point of diamond. It is engraved. And he talks about their idolatry. And he says, and you will let go of the inheritance that I gave you. And so it's a fulfillment of these kind of Deuteronomy curses that comes out. But here you've got the kind of joyous beginning of the story, that they are now being given the inheritance that God has always has been promising them for generation upon generation. But as we get to the end of this section, we're going to find that Joshua says, if you want to retain this land, you need to be faithful to the Lord. And there's a song, I think, that goes along very well with that. And Stan's going to lead us in that song. Thank you, brother. What do we have, 5 minutes left? All right. So let's see how far we can get through here. Sorry I had to make the text just a little bit smaller for this one. I had a little bit longer lines on some of these, and so I had to reduce some things just a little bit. Let's see if we can come up with some of the main ideas of this. We may not get all the way through. We may have to pick up on Sunday. But in Joshua chapter 13, as you were reading through, what did you find was kind of the main story element of chapter 13? Dividing the land. Very good. So you've got inheritance. I kind of cheat on my rule of about one or two words, and we actually have three words here. I wanted to try to, for myself, memorize what tribes were discussed in each chapter. So for this one, you have kind of a review of the inheritance that was given to Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. And I did notice back weeks ago when I was trying to develop some memory devices for each of these, that whenever you have a bunch that end in teen, it makes it a little bit harder sometimes to just come up with unique ones. Whereas 1 through 12, they all sound a little bit different. You can be a little bit more creative. I had to get a little bit more creative in order to try to figure out some of these with all the teen sounds. So for 13, I started looking at the numbers, and I saw 1, 3. So the first three tribes to receive an inheritance, 1, 3, the first three tribes to receive their inheritance had already received their inheritance on the east side of the Jordan. So 1, 3, first three tribes to receive their inheritance was on the east side of the Jordan, and that was Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. And that's the order that it goes through in that text. Then when you get to chapter 14, what happens next? If chapter 13 is the people on the east side of the Jordan, what do you think is going to start in chapter 14? On the west side of the Jordan. And who is discussed in chapter 14? Caleb. And what tribe is Caleb from? Judah. All right, so we have Caleb, and I'm going to label this one Judah 1, because we actually have two chapters with Judah. And I use that 1-4 concept again, first four. So the first four tribes on the west side of the Jordan all begin with J. So first four tribes all begin with J. So the first three are Reuben, Gad, and half-tribe of Manasseh on the east side. Now we've moved over to the west, and the next four chapters are all going to start with J's. So Judah, the first is Judah, specifically Caleb. So Judah, specifically Caleb. And so the next chapter, chapter 15, is going to be another J, because the first four on the west side of the Jordan start with J. And so if we have Judah 1, what do you think is going to be next? Judah 2. Very good. All of you get A's. All right, so Judah 2, you have the inheritance proper of Judah. And for 15, started with F, and so it follows Caleb, and it follows Judah 1, so you have Judah 2. Again, it was hard for me to get creative with some of these. You can use whatever scheme you want, but I just tried to remember 14, the first four, start with J, and so you have Judah 1, Caleb, Judah 2 for chapter 15. It follows Caleb, follows Judah 1, which then brings us to chapter 16. And this one's kind of a trick question, but what tribe also starts with J? Joseph. So we're going to have the tribe of Joseph, but that's not one you see in the land. What do we have for Joseph? Ephraim and Manasseh. So we have Joseph number one is Ephraim. Why do you think Ephraim comes first? You have to remember back to Genesis. Yeah, because he was given the blessing. Remember the switching of the hands? And the younger was going to be given the preeminence. And so Joseph number one. And if you want a bit of a rhyme, Joseph number one, 16, Ephraim, if you're pronouncing it in Hebrew, but it's Ephraim. So 16, Ephraim, that's how I remember it. You don't have to remember it that way. But chapter 16 is your third J, and it is Joseph number one, which the firstborn, or the inheritor of Joseph, who took the rights of the firstborn, would be Ephraim. Which I know we're out of time, but what do you think is next? Joseph 2, Manasseh. All right. And so just remember Joseph 2 for that one. So there's your first four that start with J. We'll continue on in chapter 18 next time. Any final comments or questions? All right. Appreciate everyone's participation.